Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Maher, and I will be your host for today's forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 under the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally, in D.C., and in 35 nations around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in D.C., and over $300,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. Today's forum is on UK-US relations. Our guest is Sir Peter Westmacott. Sir Peter Westmacott became British ambassador to the United States in January 2012. This is his second posting in Washington, having previously served as the British Embassy Consular for political and public affairs in the mid-1990s. Prior to his service as ambassador to the United States, Peter served as the British ambassador to France from 2007 to 2011, as ambassador to Turkey starting in 2002. Peter's 40-year career in the British diplomatic service has included postings to Tehran and Brussels. Time as the Foreign and Commonwealth Office Director of Americas and a seat on the board of the Foreign Office as Deputy Undersecretary. In addition, he has served as Deputy Private Secretary to His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales from 1990 to 1993. Please join me in welcoming our guest.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for coming along. I'm told that afternoons are not a good time at University of Utah for a number of reasons, not just getting over lunch, but also because of commuting schedules and so on. So I appreciate that those of you who have come have turned out. I was also told a little bit earlier that I'm expected to speak for 40 minutes and then leave a quarter of an hour or so for questions. I don't think you will be able to put up with me for 40 minutes, so I'm going to speak for rather less than that. And then we can perhaps have a slightly longer discussion. But we'll see where we get to. US-UK relations, Maher, yes, I'm very happy to talk a bit about that, and I'll talk a little about the UK. But I thought it might be of some interest to you if we stray a bit beyond that and look at some of the global challenges and the big issues which are out there today, and particularly with the perspective of how the US and the UK are trying to work together to deal with some of those issues. But allow me to begin by saying that it's a huge honor for me to come here. I've never been to the University of Utah before. I've only even been to the state of Utah once before, 20 years ago, when I brought my family to do some skiing. But I have been learning that there are some very important links between this state, this city, and my country. We are, by a long way, for example, the most important export market for the state of Utah in the world. 30% of all this state's exports go to the United Kingdom. A lot of them are precious metals and gold and bullion and so on, but never mind. It's still a very important contribution. And we are, by a very long way, the country which has the highest per capita ancestry of all Utahns. That is to say, more people have roots in the United Kingdom than in any other country in the world in Utah. I'm sure that's changing as the nature of the country alters, but as of now, that is an important part of what we have got together. And it's also, I think, worth saying that just as I was talking to the governor earlier today and talking to some business people at lunchtime, just as this is a state which is very business friendly, which is very determined to attract more inward investment, which is buzzing along in lots of different areas, including biotech and aerospace and IT, as well as the prosperity that comes from mining, this is also something which my own government is trying to do. We have been through a very difficult and painful recession. We had a very large financial services sector. We went into a deep hole after the meltdown of 2008, and we've been struggling to come out of it since then. We've done two things simultaneously. One is try to get our public finances under control, because we found ourselves with a very high level of debt. We had 11% of the annual deficit, of the annual budget, was a deficit, which is unsustainably high if you're not a reserve currency. And we also had very low levels of growth, and we had levels of unemployment that were rising. People said, you've either got to deal with the public finances and get the debt under control, or you've got to stimulate your economy. You can't really do both. And by the way, at a time of recession is when you need counter-cyclical investment to get your economy going again. Well, we ignored the experts to some extent and tried to do both. And over the last few months, we've begun to see the results of having done both, that is to say, keep going with investment in infrastructure and business-friendly policies and creation of jobs, while at the same time get the debt under control. And amazingly, it has begun to work. We've got the deficit down from 11% to 6.5%. It'll be 5.5% in the financial year, which is just beginning this month of April. And we're looking to eliminate that deficit altogether in about another 3 to 4 years. And at the same time, the IMF has just told us that they expect the UK's economy to grow at 2.9% in 2014, which may not sound fantastic, but it is better than anybody else in Europe. It is actually slightly better than the current estimate for the US growth. And considering that 18 months ago we thought we were looking at a triple-dip recession, it's quite a remarkable turnaround, and we're very pleased with that. It's fragile. There's a long way to go. Our exports are not as strong as they should be, perhaps partly because the Eurozone, which is the part of the European Union which has got its own currency, the euro. We're not part of that, but we are all part of the European Union. The eurozone is still weak, and that is where half of our foreign trade traditionally has been. And if they're not growing, then it's quite hard for us to get our exports improving. But there are other reasons, too, that we're not quite as strong as we'd like to be in exports. We were worried that investment in the future was not going very well, but we actually saw industrial investment grow by 8.8% last year, which is a much better figure than we had before, and that suggests that confidence in the future is coming back. It suggests the banks are doing their job. It suggests that people who are planning on having capacity and products in the future, which the market will want, have got the confidence now to borrow the money to do just that. So we feel that the economy is coming back, and that is something that's important, but it's a parallel track, as far as I can see, to the economic strategy which is being followed here. I'm hugely impressed, for example, that unemployment is down at 3.8%, 3.9% in the Utah, when the national average is around 7. Ours is just below that. We're at 6.9 now. Too high, but almost half what the European Union average is of 11 or 12% unemployment. But I think it's a sign of how well this state is doing, and we're delighted to have such a strong economic and commercial relationship with Utah. I start by saying that because I think the business success and the expansion and the growth of the economy here is a big part of what this state is all about. But it's also a big part of what I, as a diplomat, am all about. There are three things that we're supposed to do, British diplomats. It all comes under three headings. One is called prosperity, which is developing the UK's economy to the extent that we can help with exports, investment, mergers, protection of overseas investors, support of the business relationship, and a whole bunch of other things that we can do, helping invest in R&D, develop the partnerships between universities and private sector, and we do a lot of that. Biggest single thing that my network of 750 people across America does is to promote business, promote trade and investment. So that's part of what we do. Broadly speaking, the prosperity agenda. Second thing we do is what we call international security, which is an umbrella term that deals with all aspects of foreign policy, trying to stop wars, resolve conflicts, deal with the complex foreign policy issues in the Middle East or in Africa or at the moment Central and Eastern Europe or wherever it happens to be, South and East China Sea. All that broad sort of foreign policy stuff is what we call security work. And the third thing we do, which is what the British taxpayer pays us to look after, is consular work abroad. That is to say, British citizens overseas who might need help because they've got into trouble, lost their passport, got in a car crash, been sent to jail, whatever it happens to be. That is traditionally what embassies and consulates around the world used to do, and that remains an important part of our work. So those are the three main headings which dominate our work and which we are responsible for following through. Allow me to say that I think that there's a lot of people in this university who might be well placed to follow that kind of a path, whether you're interested in more prosperity or the foreign policy stuff or the looking after of your own fellow citizens abroad, because I've been learning just how strong the young of the state of Utah have become in foreign languages. Some of it, of course, is LDS missions abroad. Some of it is the strength of this university. Some of it is the international climate within which you have all been brought up. But I just want to say one thing. I'm a great believer in the learning of foreign languages and culture, both because it's an enriching process, but also I do not see how you can effectively represent your country abroad if you do not know the language and the culture of the place where you are living. It's not always possible. We've got some people in China and Thailand and Russia and some Arab countries who are not fluent in Mandarin, Cantonese, Russian, Thai, Arabic, or whatever it is. But we try and match skills with the countries where we send people to. And I've been lucky enough in my own case, never in my 40 years as diplomat, to have had to live in a country of which I did not speak the language more or less fluently, sometimes a bit less well than I would have wished. But those of you who are looking at that, those of you who have got foreign language skills, good for you. I think it's hugely valuable for lots of different ways, and it's a pretty useful preparation for doing the kind of work that we do. Back to the US and UK, and perhaps just a little bit more on the UK and Utah. We're rather proud of the fact that this state and my country, which are, by the way, about the same size. You put England, Scotland, and Wales together, you get an area about the same size as Utah. We've got slightly more people. I think you've got 3 million and we've got 70, but the population density is a matter of difference between us. But you've had a very successful Winter Olympics here back in 2002. We're very proud of the fact that we had Olympic Games in 2012. Both Olympics and Paralympics for the disabled, which were a huge success, were something which I think helped to put any one of us, whether it's Salt Lake City, Utah, or the United Kingdom, on the global map. And I just want to say how pleased we were that we imported 8 tons of precious metals, silver and gold, from Utah in order to make 4,700 Olympic medals for the people who won the races and the competitions in the Olympic Games back in 2012. So there's another little area where we are important in terms of that relationship. So this overall subject of prosperity and trying to move ahead with economic growth, jobs, prosperity, hugely important, I think, especially now when we have all been coming through a difficult recession sprung by all that sort of out of control derivative stuff, the collapse of Lehman Brothers, bubbles here, bubbles there, debt financed, subprime mortgage financed, whatever you want to call it. It made a terrible mess and it caused an awful lot of hardship in a lot of different countries. I hear that 20% of households, even in America, are still underwater. In other words, people borrowed more money than their property is currently worth. I think we're just through that in the UK, but it's an indication of just how painful it has been. So getting out of all that, getting our economies back in good shape, is a very important part of what we do. And one of the areas of activity which is a high priority for me, for my team, across America, and I've got 10 consulates general here who focus very largely, as I was saying, on trade and investment, is to try to promote the current negotiations for free trade which are going on between the European Union and the United States. European Union, 450 million people. United States, 300 and whatever it is, 10, 20, 30 million. Half the world's GDP between us. 750 million, probably most prosperous and most sophisticated, best informed consumers in the world. If we can develop a free trade agreement between us, a genuinely comprehensive one, we think it's win-win for everybody. The economists tell us that it should add about 2% perhaps to GDP of both Europe and the United States, without anybody actually being penalized, without anybody suffering. It's not displacement of other people's prosperity. It's the creation of wealth, jobs, prosperity that is in addition to what we have now. By getting rid of tariffs, by getting rid of some of the barriers to trade, by agreeing that we can have the same technical standards for, you know, motor cars, light bulbs, whatever it happens to be, technological stuff, new cameras, new technologies. If we can agree to have the same standards, then there's an awful lot more that we can do to give consumers the same product at a cheaper price rather than to have completely separate regulatory arrangements. And that's an important part of what we're trying to negotiate in this thing which is called TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which will, we hope, lead to free trade between US and European Union. There are several different sectors where it may be complicated. Some of the services sectors, you know, aerospace and shipping and so on, airlines, insurance, financial services. This may be quite tricky because we're keen that this should be comprehensive. It's got to cover all those things, plus agriculture and textiles and GM crops and so on, to the extent that we can. Otherwise, we're not going to have all the benefits which we really want to see coming from this thing. But we're pushing hard on this, and we're trying to break down some of the barriers and to ensure that there is a much greater degree of convergence between the regulations that dominate our economies in Europe and the economies here, so that we are more capable of taking on the rest of the world in a competitive manner. So we're pushing ahead with that. My Prime Minister was pushing for that pretty hard over the last couple of years. The President of the United States endorsed it wholeheartedly in his State of the Union speech just over a year ago. And we're optimistic, I think, between us, Europeans and Americans, that perhaps sometime towards the end of next year we ought to be able to reach such an agreement. It won't be easy. As I said, there are some difficult areas, and we don't yet have fast-track authority from the United States Congress, which is usually, it's not essential, but it does certainly help give credibility to trade negotiations, and it makes people feel there's some point and worth getting on with it, because when the work is done, that Congress should be able to vote it through up or down rather than do a line-by-line examination and renegotiation of the details. For the moment, the Senate is not going to agree the fast-track authority that the administration has asked for, but perhaps after the midterm elections in November, things will look a little bit different. Either way, this is a high priority for all of us. It's part of our global prosperity agenda, and we think it is worth pressing ahead with that. Now, in terms of the three little headings I gave you, consular work, prosperity, security, it looks may look like they're distinct, but I think the second part, if you like, of what I want to say to you is that, in fact, security and prosperity have become more and more linked in a lot of different ways. You look at almost any of the global issues which are on the agenda at the moment, which are foreign and security policy problems for us, many of them have got a real security aspect. Take Iran, for example, where we are working hard between us across the Atlantic, the five permanent members of the Security Council, plus Germany, to try to ensure that we have an agreement with the Iranians whereby they will not have any nuclear weapons and whereby their capacity to break out from a civil nuclear program they have at the moment to having weapons in the future is sufficiently wide, that the gap is wide enough that we can, with an adequate system of inspections and transparency, be confident that they're not going to suddenly surprise us by having a nuclear weapon. Those negotiations have been going on for a number of years, as those of you who follow these things will know, but it does have quite an impact on the prosperity of our global economy. Iran is not able to export its oil and gas to the extent that it would like. We have got some very stringent sanctions, financial, all banks, economic, as well as oil and gas, defense sales, aerospace, you name it, it's all there, which are part of the means of putting pressure on the Iranian government so that they don't go ahead with their nuclear military program and indeed negotiate with the rest of us in good faith so that we don't have suddenly a nasty surprise, as in North Korea, of having nuclear weapons. But there is a real cost to global trade, particularly to the Iranian economy. It's actually one of the principal reasons why they have agreed to negotiate, we believe, in good faith with the West at the moment, because of the severe impact of those sanctions. So that there is a link there between the two. There's a link also in terms of the broader stability in the Middle East to our prosperity. At different moments when, for example, between Israel and Palestinians, there have been difficult moments, we've suddenly seen the oil price spike, which has had an instant impact usually on our economic prospects through the oil price. And remember that when the Berlin Wall came down, when the Warsaw Pact collapsed, back at the end of the early 90s, price of crude oil was about $20 a barrel. Today it's well over 100, and that is an indication of one reason, in my view, why those changes happened. The Soviet regime could no longer afford to pay for an empire which was coming apart and didn't wish to remain under the thumb of the Soviet Union. And today, if you look at perhaps the most immediate and the most, in my personal view, worrying of the international crises that we're trying to deal with, which is Crimea, Ukraine, Russia, there is a very direct link again to prosperity. What are we going to do to ensure that President Putin realizes that you cannot help yourself to a chunk of your next-door neighbor's territory against all constitutional and legal propriety, and against the rule of law, and against the principles of the United Nations, to which you have a particular responsibility if you're a permanent member of the Security Council, which Russia is, then if you're not going to go to war in Ukraine, and there is no international appetite for doing that, you've actually got to find some ways of putting the real squeeze on them, which comes down to economic and prosperity issues. So far, what's been done in response, apart from a number of very strong, very clear political statements from all of our political leaders, has been about asset freezes and visa bans on some of the most influential oligarchs who are responsible for supporting what was the previous regime in Ukraine and some of the things that are going on in Ukraine now at Russian behest, and who are active inside Russia. There's a Russian bank which has been sanctioned by the United States. We have been preparing in the last few days the possibility of having to put significantly more substantial trade sanctions, defense sales, and other things on Russia if the situation in Ukraine continues to deteriorate. As of today, we are quite worried about it. You've probably seen that the Ukrainian army, which eventually, after being very, very restrained in the face of a lot of provocation, sent some military forces down to try to defuse politically rather than militarily the occupation of a number of government buildings in some of the eastern and central parts of Ukraine. Half a dozen of their tanks were taken over by what's called pro-Russian protesters, who tend to be Russian soldiers in uniforms with the badges ripped off. And so there is a high degree of tension at the moment. Where are we going to be between Russia and Ukraine? Does President Putin seriously wish to invade part of Ukraine and manufacture some pretext by getting his thugs and other people to engineer a provocation? Or would he like to have a serious discussion about where Ukraine goes for now, goes in the future, with, of course, the authorities of Ukraine? It remains to be seen. There's a very important meeting coming up tomorrow between the United Nations, European Union, Russia, United States, Ukraine, called the Contact Group, and we hope that that will lead to a de-escalation and to a defusing of this crisis. But we have all been deeply disappointed by the way in which President Putin's behavior has, in a sense, flaunted all the principles to which the international community has been attached since we created the UN and since we ended up with a different sort of world at the end of the Second World War. One of the side effects of that has been that the Europeans and North Atlantics, who are part of NATO, this treaty which guarantees our territorial security against any external attack, suddenly becomes a bit more relevant. People were saying to themselves a little while ago, what do you need NATO for? You've got an alliance which doesn't have a purpose. You're doing a bit of out of area, this and that, in Africa or the Balkans or somewhere else, or trying to deal with Somali pilots. But NATO was set up to defend the territorial security of North Atlantic countries in Europe and North America. Where's the threat? We volunteered the Brits to host the next NATO summit, which will be in September of this year, because nobody else wanted to do it, because it was, may have been about Afghanistan, but if it wasn't Afghanistan, then, well, it'll be about NATO concepts, which don't really inspire lots of people, and it costs tons of money because of security and policing and putting up 60 or 70 different delegations. Anyway, we did that. We decided that we would host that summit. And hey presto, suddenly you find that nobody's asking themselves the question, what's NATO for anymore? It's more a question of, we've got this NATO, is it fit for purpose? Is it able to provide the guarantees to the members of NATO, which include three countries which used to be part of the Soviet Union, against the possibility of a territorial threat from next-door neighbor in Russia? Ukraine, of course, not part of NATO, let me be clear about that, and nobody's talking about the idea of any of the NATO countries intervening militarily in NATO. President Obama ruled that out very clearly in an important speech he made in Brussels about 10 days ago, 2 weeks ago. But we do have obligations to every single member of NATO, and people are having to refresh their memory of what those obligations are and ensure that we are in a position to honor them if, God forbid, we needed to do so. And it's relevant also to the fact that over the last few years, the United States of America, not unreasonably, has been saying, why is it right that we have to pay 75% of the bill for NATO and the other 27 members of the alliance are barely honoring their commitment to spend 2% of their GDP, of their national wealth, on defense? The United States spends a lot more, spends somewhere in the region of 3.5%. We're about 2.4% in the UK. France is not far behind. But most of the other European members of NATO, to be honest, have not been pulling their weight. And I think we are going to have to think about that, those of us on the European side of the Atlantic, so that the alliance is indeed credible and fit for purpose in the future. So the world is a complicated and a rather dangerous place at the moment. Much of it is about security, borders, old-fashioned threats from hostile neighbours, which is the sort of thing that we thought had put behind us after the Second World War and the collapse of the Berlin Wall, but perhaps not. It's a wake-up call for us. It's a nasty surprise to see the Russians behaving as they are. And meanwhile, we've got a lot of complicated issues which are going on in the Middle East. Secretary John Kerry, who I think deserves all of our admiration for the extraordinary energy he puts into foreign policy and trying to solve a number of Middle Eastern issues and Afghanistan and dealing with China and Korea and China Sea as well, is busy trying to salvage a very complex set of negotiations between Palestinians and Israel at the moment. Very much something which is one of his personal initiatives. He put it together. He has supervised it very closely. The current 9 months expires at the end of April. It's almost certain that there will be no framework agreement. They're talking now about trying to extend the deadline. Who knows whether that will work? It's become somewhat bogged down. But there is the United States Secretary of State deeply engaged in that issue, as well as half a dozen other very important, high-profile international security issues. The antithesis, if I can put it like that, to the suggestion which we have been hearing sometimes in the op-ed columns of both American and European newspapers, that somehow America is disengaging from the rest of the world and no longer cares about global crises or international security. I think the opposite is clear from the energy which the Secretary of State puts into these issues, and indeed to the engagement of the President and the White House, sometimes in support of or sometimes in parallel to what the State Department and Secretary Kerry are doing. Our role is to work very, very closely with our European partners, of course, on these foreign policy issues, but we also engage extremely closely with the United States. Today and yesterday, there was Secretary Kerry talking to his opposite number, talking to me, my Prime Minister talking to President Obama, everybody talking to Chancellor Merkel and President Hollande about the crisis in Ukraine, and engaging on a basis of total transparency and trust. The UK, the US go back a very long way on all this. It is true that 200 years ago we were unfortunately on the wrong side, or opposite sides of a minor war, the War of 1812, which came to an end at the end in almost 200 years ago, and where we're already preparing a kind of anniversary of the Battle of New Orleans, which was the last battle of that war, which was the beginning, really, of a military partnership and a defense alliance such as the world hasn't actually ever seen before, if you look at the number of times that we've been shoulder to shoulder dealing with the defense of our own values and our own interests. But since that, for the last 200 years, we have been extraordinarily close allies. And today we have closeness of military intelligence, broader foreign policy, security relationship, which is second to none. When we finish building our new aircraft carriers in the UK, and the Queen is going to launch a new 65,000-ton ship on 4th of July, appropriately, you know, there will be American fighter aircraft flying off that aircraft carrier, as well as British ones. There are UK pilots flying US aircraft. There are British naval officers on US naval vessels, and vice versa. So we have a long tradition of working together in dealing with these issues. And as these challenges are in front of us, I think that relationship, that alliance, has shown to be as valuable as ever. And we certainly treasure it, and I like to think that it is helpful for us and for America's other partners to be in such close contact. My last point being that I think not unreasonably what we've seen in recent years is that when there has been a really difficult issue to address, the President of the United States, reflecting, I would say, public and congressional opinion, has been quite reluctant to get involved in stuff as the sole policeman of the world and the defender of our Western values without involving other people. On the back of Iraq and Afghanistan, and even to some extent Libya, I think public opinion is deeply wary about foreign military entanglements. Not surprisingly, that is the case in Britain, it's the case in France, it's the case here in the United States, and it's certainly the case elsewhere in Europe. Not surprisingly, therefore, even the President of the United States wishes to be, as far as I can see, in good company if he's going to have to take military action in defense of the values which we all hold dear. That means that relationships with close allies and partners are as important as ever. That's very clear from the last defense statement put out in
accompanying the administration's defense budget just a couple of weeks ago by Defense Secretary Hagel, and it's certainly the basis on which we are planning our future defense capabilities and our future military spending. So that remains, I think, lock solid and a very important part of the international architecture with which we work to try to make the world a safer and better and, back to my point of departure, more prosperous place. So there we are. I think that's enough from me by way of opening remarks. Prosperity, security, protection of our interests and our subjects overseas, but some pretty close links between issues of security and prosperity at a time when the world is feeling slightly nervous and insecure, but when our economic recovery in all of our countries remains so fragile that we need to work even harder together to do more trade, more investment, and to negotiate as many free trade agreements as we can. So there we are. Thank you very much for listening. I am at your disposal if you would like to ask me either about any of that or about things that I haven't talked about.
So we're now some time for questions. Please wait for the mic and please say your full name when asking a question.
Tim Wells, and you touched a bit on the international security and the security both of the United States as well as the UK, and I'm thinking with the seeming blowback domestically in the UK from the particularly involving the folks at Cheltenham, with the do you think it might be, and I'm not trying to tempt you into an indiscretion,
good,
it might be time to perhaps review that relationship between the services and their American counterparts? And as a real brief one, do you think the UK may be reviewing its relationship perhaps on another level with its participation in the EU, considering the current discussion in Brussels over the number plates and going to something more generic, European generic? And I know that's not entirely serious, but my first question really is. Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Okay. Do we think it's time to review intelligence relationships, particularly the one between the United States and the United Kingdom? I would say no. In terms of the agencies. Is it time to look at what we do and how we do it and whether we need to do it? I think that's a different question. I think what Edward Snowden has done and the newspapers to whom he gave a whole lot of what we regard as stolen intelligence material, stolen from the United States, stolen from the British government, is something which was not profoundly helpful and not actually, in my judgment, a blow for freedom and perhaps transparency, if that's your point of view. But the reality is that in a dangerous world, we all do need to carry out intelligence operations. We need to know what's going on when people do not wish to tell us. We need to know about cyber attacks against our interests, our businesses, our intellectual property, and our national security. And there are tens of thousands a week of those being launched. We need to know about terrorism. We need to know if there is some guy, as there was not very long ago in Yemen, who was being fitted out with a very fancy set of underwear, which was a bomb designed to blow up an aircraft between somewhere in Europe and the United States. And we've had a guy with some shoes which were designed to do that. We've even had an underpants bomb before which didn't go off because the guy got the detonation wrong. If we're going to catch those people before they kill 300 people in an aeroplane crossing the Atlantic, we do actually need to have the ability to trace their phone calls and find out who they're talking to. It's not about listening in to everybody's private phone calls. It just isn't. But it is about having computer systems which mean that if we get a lead on somebody who's up to no good or might be up to no good, that we can find out who he's talking to or she's talking to, and that we can therefore trace who that person might be before the bomb goes off on the aeroplane or in the New York subway or in the London Underground, as it did for us about 8 years ago. So there is a need for this stuff. Is there a need for voyeurism and eavesdropping on people's private communications when there is absolutely no security threat? No. And mass data is not actually mass surveillance. Mass data collection is having the means to look at individual numbers and calls if you need to. It's not about listening to everybody just as a matter of course. So I think there's a certain amount of misunderstanding that's been out there, partly as a result of the way in which Snowden and his friends have revealed how it's done. It's also had an impact already on our national security because some of the things that we were doing, which have now been made public, mean that the bad guys can find other ways of covering their traces and disguising their means of talking to each other. And that is a matter of some concern, so we have to spend a lot more money on looking at that. All that said, I know that the President took the view, and so did Secretary Kerry and other members of the administration, that there was a sense that the machine had got a bit out of control, that it was doing stuff because it could rather than because it needed to. The President has made his views very clear in a big speech. There are a number of follow-through actions about ensuring there is proper political control over all intelligence gathering operations. We have that in the United Kingdom. Every single warrant that is required to listen to this or that phone call has to be signed off by a senior politician, and there is a parliamentary oversight process which we believe means that everything is in keeping with the law and with national security. Do we need to continue to do that stuff together? Well, I think we do, because if any one country starts trying to do this all by itself, it is extraordinarily difficult and expensive, and it might get even more intrusive. A number of the governments which have complained on the back of the Snowden disclosures that they were deeply offended by this intelligence gathering, they do exactly the same thing, because they too have a responsibility to look after their own national security by ensuring that if there is important information which isn't in the public domain, that they can get it in other ways. So I think we need to be very clear about public accountability. We need to be clear about trust, about legality, but I think we also need to continue to have a capacity to protect ourselves against criminals and terrorists who are increasingly sophisticated in the ways in which they go about their business. The UK and European Union number plates, you know, it's a bit up there with a bit of scaremongering that went on in the UK, saying, do you know what the European Union is trying to make us do now? They want straight bananas and square tomatoes so that they can pack them more efficiently. Well, that was a red herring which was spread by the kind of Eurosceptics in order to make people think the European Union was an awful thing. The United Kingdom has a complicated relationship with the European Union. We are a key member at the heart of it, we like to think. We are absolutely at the heart of policy making and a lot of the innovation and the Lisbon agenda and the single market and common foreign policy. All those initiatives have had a lot to do with the UK. But there is a sense in the UK that European Union doesn't work as well as it should, that it's not as accountable and transparent as it should be, and that to some extent it may be doing things which would be better done by member states. So there's an issue of what we call in the jargon subsidiarity. And what we have done, my Prime Minister has said, if he's re-elected, and we have a general election in the UK in just over 1 year's time, if he's re-elected, what he will aim to do is to negotiate better terms of membership with a better functioning European Union and seek a fresh consent from the British people as to whether we stay in or whether we leave. It is a strategy which is intended both to improve the way Europe works, and we've got a number of allies, by the way, who agree with us that it needs to be improved, and to keep the United Kingdom inside a better functioning European Union. That's what the plan is. Are we reviewing? Yes. Are we trying to improve it? Yes. Do we intend to leave the European Union? No, I do not think so. There are people within the Conservative Party. You've got the Tea Party here who've got strongly held views. There's fringe parties as well in other European states which have got strong views which are a little bit out of the mainstream. That's for sure. Public opinion is pretty sceptical about much of the way the European Union functions. That's why we want to try and make it work better, but it is not a plan to take the UK out of the European Union, and we are confident that with the support of a lot of our friends and allies we can make it work better. And I hope, anyway, that the British people, if they are consulted in that referendum, because it does depend a bit on the outcome of the next general election, that we will vote to remain a strong player at the heart of an effective and outward-looking European Union.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Ambassador. My name is Kurt Manwaring, and I feel more comfortable standing.
Okay.
Anyway.
That's fine.
I have so many questions for you, but I guess I'll limit myself to this. Obviously, you know, there's a lot of talk about the special relationship between the U.S. and the U.K., and as you have so eloquently put forward earlier, that relationship is very strong indeed. However, And as Tim said earlier, I don't want to pressure you into any sort of an indiscretion or anything like that.
Appreciate it.
But I am curious, because obviously the U.S. and the U.K. is not just one single monolith, what are some of the main points of disagreement between your government with Prime Minister Cameron and President Obama, and how do you see resolving some of those specific disagreements? Thank you.
Thanks for the question. There aren't very many, but there are some, and that's how it always has to be. Each country, each government has a duty to look after its own national interests. I would say that between the US and the UK, on pretty well all the subjects that I have mentioned, we do see eye to eye, we have got the same values, we have got the same objectives. Will there be slight differences between us over whether and how and when military action should be taken against this or that country, or this or that set of sanctions should be applied right now? Or are there views about how companies or banks or oil firms should be regulated or disciplined when things go wrong? Or what about the extraterritoriality issue when the United States seeks to apply laws, sometimes sanctions, sometimes just rules, which do not have any legal validity outside the United States, but which they seek to apply on the rest of the world because they want the rest of the world to apply those standards, and which we regard as not appropriate. Those are all areas where we have sometimes had some quite robust exchanges. I think very rarely is it about different perspectives, different policies. On foreign policy, about the only one I can think of where I wish the United States was in a different place to where it is now would be on the Falkland Islands. Small islands, population of 3,000 people, 12,000 miles from the United Kingdom, way down the South Atlantic, where 99.6% of the population wish to remain Her Majesty's subjects. We actually need our friends to support the principle of self-determination because we've got Argentina, which claims that those islands and those people should be Argentinian. Actually, we've been there since before Argentina came into existence. And there's a long history of UK residency and governance of those islands, just as there's a long history of French or American or Portuguese or whatever governance of territories far from their homeland in other parts of the world. Because of Argentina, because we've had to fight one war on behalf of Falkland Islands, we'd love to see our friends saying that they agree with the principle of self-determination. The United States government doesn't do that for its own reasons. A number of our other friends and allies do. We would find it reassuring if it was possible, but we understand that that's something where it isn't the case. On business, I would say that there have been moments when we have found the approach of certain regulators, and there's a whole proliferation of regulators, some of them in individual states, some of them belonging to the federal authorities, some of them belonging to separate committees to do with commodities or banking or finance, where the book is thrown at foreign banks in a manner which can be, you know, pretty brutal and with very sharp deadlines, with extremely powerful threats of action, because if you are, let's say, a global bank and somebody in the state of New York says, I'm going to deprive you of your banking license and you can no longer trade in anything to do with dollars, you're actually out of business at the global level. And sometimes decisions of that sort are taken, or threats are made, in a manner which are, we believe, disproportionate to the nature of whatever the dispute is, extraterritorial and inappropriate. So we have to fight in defense of our own firms against that sort of treatment. Right now, we are disappointed that BP, a company which, alas, was the co-owner of a oil rig which blew up in the Gulf of Mexico 4 years ago, loss of life and terrible damage to the environment of the Gulf of Mexico, they put their hands up and said, we accept responsibility, and they've put up billions of dollars to clean up the Gulf and to compensate a bunch of companies, individuals, and other people who might have suffered damage from that. In the meantime, there's a whole bunch of separate court cases against BP which are going on, some of which are about trying to prevent BP's money being given to firms of lawyers and other businesses and other individuals somewhere in the six or seven states close to the Gulf of Mexico for claims totally unrelated to any damage to what's happened in the Macondo oil spill. We are disappointed that that is the way the legal system works, that demonstrable fraud is being committed at the expense of a British company, which has made one big mistake, which is to say we accept responsibility and we're going to be responsible citizens. We care about that for BP. We also care about the signal that this conveys to any future major corporate firm on whose watch something goes wrong. No one ever is going to say we accept responsibility and, by the way, here's $10 billion for starters to compensate people who suffered damage. They will follow, perhaps, an alternative, the one that Exxon pursued when the Exxon Valdez tanker did a lot of damage to the coast of Atlanta, which was to deny all responsibility and fight it through the courts and get away with minimal payments. So BP have already paid out $24 billion and are likely to pay very much larger sums in the future. And still it's being dragged through the courts in ways which we find, you know, disappointing, to put it mildly. So there are a lot of issues out there which we have to address, just like the United States addresses issues with us on different occasions. It might be the application of extraterritorial laws. It might be foreign policy issues on countries where we both have interests. I remember years ago we had a terrible battle because Scottish shortbread and cashmere jumpers were sanctioned by the United States government in connection with something to do with European Union law not being compliant with US sanctions against the Soviet Union, as it then was, to do with missile deployment. You know, we said this is not the way you treat you know, your special relationship and your trusted ally, but nothing we could do about it. That was the way the law was written. And so it's complicated. We try to address these issues on a basis of friendship, robustness, transparency, but actually the fact that I've given you these rather technical examples of things that, where we have had differences is an indication of just how rarely we do disagree on the major fronts.
Thank you for coming. My name is Brian Smith. Historically, Utah's exports, a vast majority of Utah's exports have come from precious metals, and the majority of those have gone to the UK and the London Metal Exchange. In the last year, we've seen over, I think, 80% decrease in dollar value of exports to the UK. And so a lot of that's to do with price and volume changes and decreases. However, the Hong Kong Metal Exchange recently bought the London Metal Exchange, and we've seen our export numbers almost identically be inverted to where what we were sending to the UK now is to Hong Kong. I'm wondering if that purchase has anything to do with that, or if there's anything that Utah can do to bolster their exports back to the UK and the metal exchange.
It's a really good question, but it's probably too technically demanding for me to give you an intelligent answer, but I'll try and say something about it. I spent a couple of hours with one of the big mining and refining companies this morning, and they have traditionally been sending, you know, 80% of their exports to the UK, you know, very high-value shipments of bullion, of gold and silver and so on, refined, and much of it mined here in Utah. And you're right, those numbers have gone down. It's partly about pricing. It's partly about where the stuff goes. I mean, for example, China at the moment is buying very large quantities of gold bullion as currency. In the old days, I think I'm right in saying, much of that would have gone through London. It may still be traded through London, but the direct shipment is sometimes now, I think, going straight there. There has been a lot more of exports in the past to India. India is a little problematic because there are issues about support given to Indian refiners, which means that a little bit less semi-refined bullion from Utah to India is being exported than in the past. I think overall it has to be to do with the movements of the global markets. London remains the central clearinghouse for bullion business, but the price of gold, for example, has gone down from $1,800 to $1,300 an ounce just in the last, whatever it is, 12 months or so. That must have some impact on it. But I guess it's also an issue about whether bullion is or isn't in favor. When people have got more confidence in equities or gilts, they'll probably be buying less gold and silver. When the markets are less stable, then it may be that the purchase of those things will go up. I can't give you, I'm afraid, a better answer than that. I wish it were not translated into such a volatile up and down of the numbers. But since the honest truth is that somewhere between 80 and 90% of Utah's exceptionally high level of exports to the UK are in the bullion and precious metals business, it's probably inevitable. And I don't think there's much that a quiet word from me to anybody can do about that. I think it is in the hands, really, of the markets, the prices, and the trading patterns.
Hi. My name is Carter Folger, and you actually answered question number one and question number two, and I was kind of out there. But my third question is the third runner up. You've been in the diplomacy business, for lack of a better term, for a long time now. And do you have a favorite moment that you've kind of mitigated or been with? Or, I mean, I'm sure that you have a lot of different stories, but do you have a moment that just kind of made you happy to be doing what you're doing?
There were quite a lot. But I'll tell you one, just top of my head. When I was ambassador in Turkey, one of the policies that the British government was pursuing was to try to get Turkey to open accession negotiations with the European Union. We have long believed that enlargement of the European Union has been one of the best ways of exporting values and consolidating democracy to other countries around Europe which wanted to join. Turkey is one of those, in our view, which, if it meets the entry criteria and respects human rights, rule of law, and carries through sufficient reforms in terms of open markets, inclusivity, treatment of minorities, and so on, we ought to allow them into the European Union if they wish to join. When I was ambassador there, the Turks were very keen to get these accession negotiations begun. We got to a point when we were at the anointed day, I think it was the 3rd of October 2005, when those negotiations were due to start. But at the last minute, there was a difficulty to do with the language of some statement, or what Turkey had to do or didn't have to do, or the linkage to the Cyprus problem, which was unresolved, or I've forgotten what the detail was. Anyway, at the beginning of the day, it was all off. Forget about it. The UK was the presidency in office of the European Union at the time, so we had a particular responsibility. But we were also the European government which was most forward in wanting to give the Turks the chance to join the European Union if they met the rules. Anyway, I spent the entire day negotiating in Ankara with the Turkish government, foreign minister, other people, about this language and whether we could fix it, we couldn't fix it. And at the end of the day, 7 o'clock at night, I was summoned to the party headquarters, and the prime minister and everybody else was there. Everyone was saying, it's over, it's finished, we can't do it anymore. Prime Minister turns to me saying, what do you think? And I say, well, Mr. Prime Minister, you know, here's what you've got. I've done what I can. I cannot get any more negotiating flexibility from Brussels. And in my judgment, it's the best you can get. And I think for the following reasons, you should accept it. And the others were saying, well, no, Turkey cannot be treated like this. This is absurd. This is European imperialism. We can't go on. Yes. So he makes a quick phone call to my Prime Minister, Tony Blair, who says, fortunately, the same thing that I just said. And at the end of that, it was, okay, we agree, we accept. And the Foreign Minister was dispatched, got on the plane. We stopped the clock because these things had to start at on the 3rd of October. And he arrived at the meeting began at 1 o'clock the following morning after he'd flown straight from that meeting. And because there was 1 hour time difference between Turkey and Brussels, we were able to claim that it was still, the meeting had begun on the day of the 3rd of October. And I felt I had been kind of instrumental in the middle of allowing this to happen, and the thing hadn't collapsed around my ears. And the last little bit of the story, which is why it was a source of professional satisfaction, I mean, we rescued a triumph from the jaws of disaster. About a week later, I had a visiting minister. We went to see the Turkish Prime Minister, and my visitor said, well, why was it you, in the end, you accepted? You know, you were all saying that was it, and we weren't able to get anything more for you, but you accepted it. And he said, well, I looked at Peter, whom I know well, and I could see from the grey colour of his face that there was nothing else we could get from you lot. And since I knew Peter fundamentally wanted the best for my country, I accepted. Of course, I had to ring his prime minister to show the rest of my team that I'd tried my best, but I knew I wasn't going to get anything from him either. So that was a little moment of satisfaction, in the sense that, A, there was something to show for my efforts. B, and this is what I do think is important, if you are going to be sent abroad to represent your country in another country, you have to have a relationship with those people, with that government, so that they know that you want the best for their country and you believe in its future. If not, you can't deliver tough messages, and if not, they're not going to trust you when you give them your best advice. But if you can get it right, there are moments of quiet satisfaction like that, which make you feel it's worth keeping going.
Hi, my name is Enzo Kerensky.
You're not Turkish, no, sorry. Okay.
You talked briefly about the situation in Ukraine and Crimea. My question is, what should the United Nations response be if Putin continues to attempt to annex like parts of the Ukraine?
Well, I think the first thing we have to do is make very, very clear that if there is any attempt to annex other parts of Ukraine, if there is any movement of Russian soldiers across the border, that there will be major consequences. That's why your president has been saying to us all, we have got to put really powerful sanctions in the shop window as a deterrent. In the meantime, we have to show that what's already happened, which we believe to be illegal and unconstitutional in Crimea, is not something we just accept and move on. There have got to be consequences, and that's why there are a number of sanctions already in place. But I think we have to make very clear, and I hope we will do that in tomorrow's meeting, and I hope we will do so in the next European Heads of Government meeting, and probably the United States will in the next few days make clear as well that there will be very serious consequences, both if they continue with this escalation and destabilization of Ukraine, which we believe the Russians are carrying out right now as we speak, and particularly if there is an attempt to carve off another chunk of Ukraine, which is a sovereign, independent European country, and expropriate that. So it's about a very firm response to what's happened so far. It's about diplomacy and giving President Putin every opportunity to solve this problem or to contribute to a solution through sensible discussion and negotiation involving the Ukrainians. And it's about making deterrent measures so that they understand that this is not cost-free. You know, if you've got a playground bully going around kicking all the children, they will carry on doing that until somebody stands up to them. So we feel very strongly that we've got to convey a very strong message, and that's what we're all trying to do together this week.
Well, unfortunately, that is all the time we have today. Please join me in thanking our guests.